So let me begin by thanking the organizers for the opportunity to stay here and give a talk. My talk, in a sense, will be a sequel to Marco's presentation last time. So an important ingredient in his talk was this current bracket, which I would like today not to introduce, but rather to derive, as an attempt to explain why should one be using this. In particular, I would like to show that even though it is defined as some operation on sections of some standard vector bundles, so apparently has something classical and finite dimensional, I would like to make a case that it actually belongs to the infinite dimensional universe. A little more precisely, I would like to show that this is a quasi-classical limit some vertex algebras. Well, vertex algebras by themselves are notorious, but after all, that's a tiny part of conformal field theory. And since today I will mostly stick to the quasi-classical limit, so I would like to explain that this is actually part of any two-dimensional quantum field theory or any two-dimensional variational calculus problem, if you will. Now, to end with this introduction, let me tell you that we won't need the entire universe of vertex algebras. We'll be using a certain class of them, which may be called algebras of chiral differential operators. This class was introduced some years ago by in several papers by Gorbunov, Shekman, Weintraub, and myself. And I should say that independently and in a totally different language, rather seemingly totally different language, the same class was discovered and studied by Bellingson and Brinfield. And the remark that the quasi-classical limit of this object is actually a current bracket, actually, to be precise, the Dorsten bracket, which is very close, almost a twin of the Coulomb bracket. So this remark belongs to Paul Bressler, who made it some years ago, and which seems not to have attracted too much attention. Okay, so much for the introduction. Now let me begin. Well, I will start from the very beginning. If it gets boring, let me know. So it's going to be quasi-classical limit. So just a few words what I mean by this. So suppose we have, you know, a vector space with the multiplication and associative algebra. Now suppose in addition we have a family of multiplications such that at zero this in addition is commutative, then this commutative algebra has more structure than that of a commutative algebra. It's actually a Poisson algebra in that one can, in this situation, define an extra operation. So you take two elements from A and B, you may multiply them in two different ways. This is zero at zero, so you can divide this by H and let this stand, let H tend to zero. That's a new operation. And the gadget consisting of this, and this is a Poisson algebra. And since, of course, this is all more than well known, but since I will soon give you sort of a vertex algebra generalization of all of this, let me write down technically the definition of a Poisson algebra. So So this is a triple consisting of a vector space and two operations. There are three groups of requirements. So this pair is a commutative associative algebra. This pair is a Lie algebra. And I will take your time by writing the two axioms of the Lie algebra. It's anti-commutative. And the Jacobian entity holds, that's a trilinear operation, which I find convenient for the reasons that will become apparent soon in this form. And the third group of requirements has to do with how the two operations are related to each other. So for any A, the linear transformation of bracketing with A is the derivation of the product. Okay, now to the main object of interest. So that's a Poisson algebra. Now I would like to define a vertex Poisson algebra. So this is a quadruple of sorts. There is a vector space. There is a T of sorts, I said. So there will be infinitely many operations, which I will break down into groups, one consisting of one operation and another an infinite family of operations, where T is a linear transformation. All the nth operations are multiplications of sorts. And the notation I will be using throughout is this. That's the nth multiplication of the nth product, rather, of A and B. So that the following axioms hold. So, the first group, the triple dt minus 1 is a commutative associative algebra with derivation t. Second, the triple of sorts, D, T, N greater than or equal to 0, is what's known as a vertex Lie algebra. Sometimes it's called conformal algebra by Katz and his collaborators, or Lie star algebra, as Berlinson and Greenfield call it. So that's an analog of two, of course. And what does this mean? And that's the main part of the definition, of course. I will unravel the notion of a vertex Lie algebra. So there will be three more properties. impulse, okay, three more conditions imposed. 2-1. Skew commutativity. So the nth product of A and B is not quite plus minus BNA. But here is what is correct. It's minus 1 to the n plus 1 BNA minus BN plus 1 A T applied to the whole thing plus, so the sign alternates and the generic term is like this. 1 on m factorial t to the m applied to b n plus m a. So now you may see the flowers of evil bloom. 2-2. Wait a second. Yes. So 2-2. Sort of skew jacket. So this is as follows. So that's going to be a cubic identity. When I don't impose any brackets, I mean that the operations are carried out by moving from the right, so they are nestled to the right. Minus BN AMC equals infinite sum as goes from 0 to infinity. The binomial coefficient, and then, so I take the product number S of A and B, that's an element of V, of which I take the product number N plus M minus S with C. And the last one. This and so so these are so you see I try to group the properties so that the gadget, however terrifying it looks, nevertheless, is sort of structured the best I can have it structured. So the last group of axioms has to do with properties of T. Now, wait a second. Yes. Oh, no. There is 2-3, and that's properties of T. So, the nth operation of T of A, applied to C, if you will, is the same as the usual bracket of T A N, like this. Minus A N T C and this is the same as minus A minus N A N minus 1 C. So that's the second group of axioms and the last one. Say it again. Where do we have infinite sums? In 2-2? I forgot to mention that that's a requirement that makes sense out of all of this. This is 0. There is a locality. nilpotency sort of condition. Then this takes care of making sense out of this. So finally, our third group of axioms relates this Lie algebra sort of structure to commutative associative multiplication structure. And that's easy. So each, for any A, the multiplication by nth multiplication by A is a derivation of the usual multiplication minus one. There we are. So now let's try to compare this definition to that. You see, they are sort of similar. Main ingredients of that definition constitute almost the entire second definition, except that in the second case, everything is sort of thickened. But there is the usual multiplication, and the vertexly algebra structure is reminiscent of the usually algebra structure. There are two conditions, and they indeed of the same nature. The second order and the third order, and even the way I wrote them, makes them more resemblant of each other. What are the main structural differences? There are two of them. First of all, there is the ingredient here that is totally lacking upstairs, so this extra derivation. And the second thing, there are infinitely many the algebra sort of operations. So, n equal to 0. If I have only minus 1 and 0, then yes, and I will actually make a precise statement soon how you can recover the usual Poisson algebra structure from the vertex 1. Yes, you can put t to 0, you can throw away operations numbers 1, 2, etc., and then I guess you will return to the usual definition. Although this is not important, I should say. But yes, yes, if t is 0, there are no higher operations, I guess this formula will give you the usual definition. So the substance of my today's talk will consist in deriving some consequences. Let me finish the sentence. Some consequences of this definition in some very special, particular situation. Yes, Vasya. Which three? The big three? No. The vertexly algebra gadget has nothing, doesn't involve operation minus one at all. So they are independent. So I could have started right away doing the things of substance, but since this was intended as a sort of the answer to a why question talk, I would like to explain why should we bother, why should we work with such things. And I would like to explain that all this gadget is actually forced upon us by the laws of nature, if you will. So let me make a digression. I'm not sure I should have done this, but I will try. So the right definition after aliens of Brinfeld. There is this almost legendary manuscript that just recently appeared. I bought it in a bookstore next to Fields Institute. I never believed, actually, to tell you the truth, is that it would appear, but it did. So chiral algebras. So, I would like to explain that all of this is just an explicit linear algebra way of making sense of the fact that this is nothing but the usual, very short Poisson algebra definition, except that it should be made in a different category. And this category is forced upon us whenever we replace a point with a line. So, here is how this comes about. So if you open any quantum field theory text, then on some of the first pages, you will see words to this effect. Let f of x be a function of one variable. Consider the Poisson bracket. Equals derivative of the delta function with respect, say, to y of x minus y. By the way, I should say that that's a modern presentation, but really there is nothing new in what those things have been known for years, of course. So it's amusing how for a mathematician who already doesn't know what really this means, how confusing a simple thing like that may be. So let's try to make sense out of it naively first. So it looks like they tell us so. That's a bracket of a function with itself. So perhaps it should be like this, f with f. But then it's zero. No, it doesn't work. Let's retain x and y. If so, perhaps they are talking about sort of current algebra. So we are bracketing the values of f. Doesn't work either because it's manifestly that the range is one-dimensional. No non-trivial bracket can exist there. So what is it then? But this is not to say that we have trouble computing such things. So for example, if we do believe in this, then both depend on x and y. There is no obstruction, for example, to differentiating both sides. So the second one, of course, is just the second derivative. The first one is this. But note that, of course, so they teach us in calculus, a function depending on a difference is annihilated by this. So this is minus the second derivative, isn't it? You can play with such formulas a little more. For example, we can consider the bracket of some functions of those functions, like this. Then you use, obviously, the Leibniz rule to get twice this. Now you may want to continue this game. For example, instead of squaring this thing, you may want to multiply it by a function of y. What do you do then? Well, use the Leibniz rule. So y is the bracket of x of y. Which one? This bracket of this with the square of this. Yeah. I told you, this is calculus. But then there should be this summoned. Right? But this is puzzling. There seems to be no indication as to how we bracket f of x and any concrete function of y. Since there is no indication, perhaps there is no other way to proceed than to set it equal to zero. So here we go then. All of this in my mind is a real epitome of a relation of physics and mathematics. But observe that even though we were able to compute, there is something unsettling here. You may ask yourself a question, what is f of y is y? then why the answers are so different? So here is how this should be done, how this should be made sense of. The whole point of all of this, although usually only tacitly assumed, is that, you see, F sort of mapping from C to C. So we consider a C and we give ourselves a coordinate X. Now, it's a mistake that I made, and that was a problem here, to think of X as a point. The space should be the space of maps from C to C, so that a function there is a point. In fact, it is even more convenient to go from the space of maps to the space of jets of maps, sort of dual picture. So consider the space of infinite jets of maps from C to C. Now we know the meaning of f of x. F of x, then, is naturally a function on this space. In fact, that, since we have coordinates fixed, that's just a coordinate in this space. Now we see the difference between f of x, if it happens to be x, so to say, and x itself. X is a function on C. This is a function on this space. What can be said about this space? And this is going to be the key to all the computations there. As the space of functions on any set, that's an algebra, you can multiply such things. But it carries an extra structure which is not visible for the space of functions on an arbitrary manifold. No. What's a point in the jet space? That's, if you are considering max from C to C, a point in the jet space is what? That's a point in C and x. That's a value of the function f of x. That's the value of the derivative f prime of x. So the value of f of x at a point is simply this value. In this way, that's a coordinate. So there is no function, really. There is no honest map. But it is convenient to work just with jets. That's the meaning of this. So that's an algebra, as the space of any functions on a space is. But it is more than that. It is a module over the space of functions on C. Well, I'm of course sloppy here. You should talk about, you know, sheaves of such things, but let us not worry about such details. Even more is true. You know, the space of jets carries a canonical connection. That is to say, vector fields on C operate on functions on the jets. Of course, I used it. Derivative with respect to x of f of x is, of course, f prime of x. So if you use these as coordinates, you may say that the connection, the value of the connection on dx is, for example, df of x times f prime of x, etc. So this is just a part of the definition of the connection. These two are summarized by saying that this thing is a module over differential operators on C. Now we're coming closer to our task. So what does this bracket mean? So since we describe the arguments of the bracket as functions on the jet space, the question arises, is this bracket simply a Poisson bracket on the algebra of functions on the space of jets. If it were, then it would be natural to impose conditions that it preserves, it's not just the Poisson algebra structure, but it preserves this extra structure, so that and respects DC module structure. This is sort of right thinking, but this is wrong. After all, we haven't yet explained why f of x and why f of y. We saw that it is important how we formalize. Likewise, well, there is this delta function, and I'm quite happy to consider the delta function as a usual function, just a second, as a usual function, but I'm not prepared to consider this delta function as an element of the space of functions on the jet space. This is quite impossible. So one more step is needed. Yes. On Poisson bracket, on the space of functions. Because if you fix a coordinate, a point in the jet space is a collection of numbers, x, f of x, f prime of x, f two primes of x, etc. These are just coordinates. So f of x is a function equal to the second coordinate on my list. Oh, I erased it. Point in the jet space is sort of element of C infinity or R infinity. It consists of x, f of x, f prime of x, etc. So it's just the second coordinate in this. No, that the whole point of that calculation, once you believe that f of x is a usual function of x, you run into trouble. I tried to show you this. F of x is to be understood differently. That's a function on the space of jets. Yes, of course, they are totally, of course. You even can't really honestly specify. You can say f of x, but you can't say f of 1/2. Sort of. It makes sense. So how do we go about explaining x and y, and how do we go about explaining this? Well, I will have to be a little technical, but I will soon do a very concrete computation, and I hope we will all have a sense of coming to grips with all this stuff. So we have to separate functions, sort of, in x. So functions in x and functions in y. How do you do that? So in general, suppose, forget about that our space is the space of function on the jet space. That's a D module. So suppose there is some DC module, meaning that it's like functions in X, in that you can differentiate them, multiply by other functions in X. We have to make sense out of A of X and A of Y, where X and Y are two copies of the same copies, but different copies of the same coordinate on C. What is it? Technically, that's as follows. You have direct product of C and C, and you have two projections on the first factor and on the second. You have A living here and A living there. So there is this, technically, there is this pullback operation. To make it a shift on C times T. What this really means is that, you know, you pull back so that in one case the sections here are extended as constants, so to say, in the horizontal direction, or as constants in the vertical direction. So were it a usual function, the pullback of f of x here will be a function of two variables independent of the second. But you can do the same thing with any shift, in particular with a shift where vector fields act, things like that. So I will unburden my annotation by calling this A of X and this A of Y. So now I will start unraveling what this may mean. So we, in the left-hand side of this famous bracket, we have a pair of elements, obviously not on living not on C, but on C cross C, because there is X and Y. So a pair like that is sort of a section of what is technically known as the exterior product of two shapes. And very usual function, you would simply multiply them, for example. Should be obvious what this means in general. Now, the bracket then, you see, since these are D modules, this is a DCC module. Functions act there by multiplication and vector fields, and X and Y act there naturally. Those in X on this sum on this factor, and those in Y on that one. So it seems that what this bracket says is it defines a morphism. Where, the question arises, what's the range of this? Well, it's a delta function. So what's a delta function for an algebraist? Well, it's something supported on the diagonal. So if you have, you see, again, technically, there is a mapping, diagonal embedding of C into C cross C. So whenever you have a sheaf on C, you can consider it sort of direct image under this mapping, which is a sheaf on C cross C supported on the diagonal. Where just sheaves, where functions act. It's clear what that means along the diagonal, just the usual sheaf. But functions that annihilate this diagonal, and if we are in the two-dimensional situation, I would put it this way: it's a sheaf, same sheaf on this diagonal, except that X minus A kills it. Makes sense? And of course, any functional analysis student knows that delta function satisfies this condition. So I'm just axiomatizing this. So all of this is really true in the category of modules over functions. But now we have to cook up the action of vector fields. And there is no any freedom. So if this is a sheaf of DC modules, so you have the action of vector fields, you have to decide how vector fields on the plane act there. Well, vector fields tangent to this diagonal act as before, as to the transversal vector field. I'll put it a little sloppy, but it is easy to make sense out of this. In transversal direction, there's no choice. They should act freely. Just as in the old good case of the usual C function of delta function of one variable, you know that X kills it, but there are no relations whatsoever among the derivatives. So that's what I mean by acting freely. So and that's what the direct inverse delta sub star of A means. You have A on the diagonal, and the vector field in the transversal direction acts freely. So finally, we arrive to this Bailey-Sondrinfeld definition of the what they call chiral Poisson thrust. That's a morphism of D modules. Like multiplication, such that, well, what is it that we want? Anti-symmetricity and the Jacobi identity. So that you will see that mappings like that, although they are not like multiplications, so in linear algebra you have this. That's an operation. You can switch factors, you can compose such things. It is more or less clear that the same thing can be done in this geometric situation, such that the bracket of the section on the left equals minus the bracket of sections taken in the opposite order. Of course, you can flip-flop two copies of C, and this explains what I write here in the right-hand side. So that's skew symmetricity and the Jacobi. FGH. Making sense out of the Jacobi identity is a little bit more non-trivial. I would like to leave it for those interested to discover for themselves how do you compose a bracket with itself. At a certain point, you will have to move the delta slope. The image is exactly the same A, but would be fine. It's a little different. It's a little, but not much. So it's not hard to rediscover for yourself how the compositions like that are made sense of. But so given this, I hope relatively transparent calculus, you see, this definition is no longer than the classical one, and I would like to finish this by doing something concrete, so as to explain that indeed all this huge definition can be conjured up, all those numerous or almost innumerous ingredients can be conjured up by doing some very simple manipulations with that definition.
Did you say that simplest bracket that you were at the beginning, that's an example of one of these?
Exactly. I mean, it's not an example. It's exactly that. That's really, as I told you, in my opinion, that's an epitome of the relation between mathematics and physics. It is obvious. All of this is obvious for a physicist. For mathematicians, it took decades and this incredible manuscript of Bailenson and Riesen to really explain all of this. Yes. This? No, it's exterior product. It's an example of that is that if you have so functions on C times C is not really functions on if it makes sense. It's really this, not the tensor product. No, it's not usual tensor, it's the exterior tensor product. Should, if you make the usual product, you will end up with functions in one variable. But if you want to get something living on the space of double dimension, you have to take the exterior product. Now, this stands for functions depending in one variable, this stands for functions in another variable, and they mix them to... No. What's that? No. No. If you tensor over functions, then you will end up, we're doing, you know, That's geometry. We are working over functions. So if you, tensoring over C doesn't make sense. You have to tensor over functions. If you tensor over functions, then you will end up with functions in still one variable. If you want to get functions in two variables, you will get this. That's a technical matter. I mean, I guess I even wrote this somewhere. May have. Yes, yes, it's the tensor. Any further questions? That's exactly what I wanted to do. So, I really would like to show that there is nothing lofty here. It's just this, but written in a very compact and invariant form. So let me compare the two definitions. Perhaps that will answer your question. So, relating the two relating the two definitions. So what are the questions really that we wanted to address? It's first, why the derivation appears in the vertex case? And this has already been addressed. That's the reason is you have to, if you want to use functions on the jet space, then that's a D module, so there should be some derivation. So this is, in a sense, is clear. Perhaps what is more important is why infinitely many operations. V in that case, in this particular case, the space of all sections. V is the space of global sections. In particular, you don't see, so the definition are not quite global sections of this. Well, in general, this A in particular example is functions on the jet space, for example. Functions on the jet space. But global functions. If you really take all the entire space of jets of functions on C. So let's see. So why infinitely many operations? Well, suppose you want to write this bracket explicitly. I gave you the sloppy explanation of what. So this should belong. Should be supported on the diagonal, on the space like this, or if you will, like this, right? What does it really mean? That's what it means. Let me return to that picture. I told you, a D module supported on the diagonal is the usual. So you have A on each of the coordinate axes. And you can identify this diagonal with this A or this. But the entire D module is not just that. It should also contain all the derivatives in the transversal direction. What does it mean in plain English, so to say? Suppose F of X is a section of this A, of this A, for example. Then, being the same as that, but living on the on the diagonal, means that I can attach it. I will be sloppy here, but I think this is intuitively clear. I will identify F of X with F of X delta X minus Y. And the only purpose this notation serves is that this is killed You see, we discussed delta is delta function is killed by any function vanishing on it. So this is killed by x minus y. So this is A identified with something living there. How about action of vector fields? Same thing. Either f of x or f of y. And that's important, actually. That's a very good question. There are two manifestations of the same thing. You identify either in this way or in that way. But this is not the whole thing. So this delta sub star of A, so this summand is like A of x times delta of x minus y. But there will be more. You may want to differentiate, for example, with respect to y or x. So the whole thing is a direct sum like this, where delta x is differentiated with respect to x or y, whichever you like better. And an equivalent perhaps doesn't look immediately equivalent, but at least similar candidate for the same space is obtained in this way. There's Koshevara's result that says that there is only shift like that, so they should be canonically isomorphic, and I will soon show you how they are identified. But at least that's in writing. I mean, if you want to compute how you think about this space, it's this plus F0, F1 times delta prime of x minus y, etc. And any element is a linear combination of things like that, and there are no relations among them. There being no relation is equivalent to saying that vector fields in the transversal direction act freely. Let me finish this and we'll see. So, now I'm prepared to give you the answer to this question. Why infinitely many operations? Because this is going to be an infinite sum of, well, a linear infinite, perhaps, linear combination of, actually finite, but of symbols like that, which simply signify the derivative of the delta function with respect to x or y, but some coefficients, and I will simply choose to denote the coefficients do depend on f and g. So that's some element, and you pick your favorite copy, either this or this. So for example, you can start with this version, and then there should be infinite sum. But of course, it can be honestly infinite for any fixed f and g. And this, of course, in this situation is expressed by demanding that this nilpotency condition hold. You can likewise use this. You may, doesn't really matter if you use x and y. Remember, dx plus dy on delta is 0, so dx on delta is minus dy on delta. That's why infinitely many operations. And finally, if you give me a couple more minutes, and this is supposed to be a fun part, if I have the right to use this word now, let me show you, let me derive for you this skew commutativity condition. And if you look at this computation, I hope then all points where I was sloppy because I was in a hurry will be clarified, I hope. So why skew commutativity follows from this, where is my definition, follows from the usual commutativity in this particular setting. So I have already computed f of x and g of y. Now I need to compute them in the opposite direction. The prescription was, you remember, flip-flop the two copies of C. That's what I do. I have had this, and now I flip-flop them and use the same formula. To make things agree, I will use this factorial. So by the same token, I'm getting the nth product of GFS at x 1 and n factorial, and the derivative with respect to, well, should be like this. Now I have to compare the two expressions, this and this. And this should be equal minus one minus the other. How can I compare them? They somewhat different. There I had sections in Y, and here I have sections in X. So how do I compare them? First of all, simple task. Let me get rid of this derivative with respect to X and use Y. Well, I think I explained this. That's minus one to the n derivative with respect to Y. And you know, delta of x minus y, by the very definition, or Kashiwara's theorem, if you will, is the same as delta of x minus y. This is more serious. So how do I compare things in x with things in y? This is also a calculus question. What's the device? The Taylor formula. I replace this. Remember, I can differentiate. So this is like being a section of a D module, it's like being a function. I can differentiate it. So the value of the function at x, I don't have to tell you, it equals the sum as m runs from 0 to infinity of the nth derivative of this thing at y multiplied by x minus y to the nth and divided by m factorial. The sum is, of course, infinite, but that's not a problem. Focus on this, and you will see how things fit together. X minus y tends to kill the delta function. Well, there are derivatives, so there will be some struggle between function annihilating the derivative and the delta function and the derivative, but in the end of the day, functions fail because they will get killed as you commute this function to the right through the row of the derivatives. And now you simply compare the coefficients of the nth derivative. I will do a couple of terms and the rest will be clear. So, in that formula, the coefficient was, of course, the nth operation. What do we get in the right? So the nicest case is when m is 0, then so it should be minus. And if m is 0, there are no cancellations. You simply get the nth derivative. So minus minus m to the nth, these fellows taken in the opposite order. A little more demanding term is when m is 1, then this thing being moved to the right will kill exactly one derivative. So there will be something like this. You agree? Moving this to the right, so we'll hit the derivative exactly n plus 1 times. In this case, you divide by n plus 1 factorial, things will cancel, and you will get the desired 1 and n factorial. But the sign will change, or because n is replaced with n plus 1. So there will be plus minus 1 to the nth, the derivative of this thing. M was 1, so there will be a derivative. And n now is n plus 1. it doesn't take much imagination to see that as M increases, you will be getting exactly those seemingly weird, but now with absolutely natural tests. All these terms are now a result of a direct computation with the honors to goodness definition of commutativity, but in this new category as dictated by our desire to work with points replaced with functions. So now, what do we do now? I just finished my sort of introduction. So the main part was, of course, to start deriving consequences of these axioms so as to, in the end of the day, get to the Kuhn bracket and formulate some of our results. But perhaps, I guess, it's a logical thing to do just to stop. Well, whatever you want. I mean, half an hour won't suffice, I'm afraid. I mean, I just gave you an introduction. And not that I'm requiring another talk. I mean, if there are people interested. I mean, I can try to squeeze it. I mean, we can make a break. I can try to squeeze it in 30 minutes. No. But to finish what I wanted to tell you today, I definitely don't need, I hope today I will do it in one, but I hope now one lecture will definitely suffice. To finish the material, I wanted to give you classification of chiral differential operator, in particular to show you this is more or less equivalent to classifying Kuhn brackets. Kuhn brackets. Well, absolutely. If it is good for you. Well, I hope I'm not causing too much trouble. I can give, you know, an informal talk to anybody interested in any, in extra time, I mean. I don't want to disrupt, you know, that the scheduled course of this. So. Depending on what you want me to do, but to finish what I wanted to do today, one time is hope. My wife is, I guess I will have to bring my wife to the airport. I'm not sure when her plane is leaving. If it is in the morning, then it's fine, but I mean, the afternoon, say. Oh, wait a second, perhaps the plane is very early. Perhaps Friday is fine. I just have to make sure. Wait a second. It should be early, right? If you, Bob, if you fly from here to LA, some usual night, it should be very early, right?
No, actually, I remember Kat said that she's leaving at 5 here, if I remember. And even the different times she arrives at LA, about 9 here, it's also.
Then it is, yeah, this becomes problematic.
Well, you can just look at it the way around. I'll grab you at the airport.
Yeah, someone right here. I can't stay, you know, 3 hours at your court, but my brain's going to shut off.
Yeah, of course. Thursday is fine. This week or next week?
Next week.
Fine. Oh, yeah. Oh, my goodness. Oh. I'm leaving on Wednesday.
Maybe what about Friday? 5 o'clock is 5 p.m. is the departure time?
I'm not sure. That is so okay. Yes, yes, I am coming back. So I leave on Wednesday and I'll return on Saturday or Sunday. Thank you very much. That was an intuitive explanation, but this is actually a theorem that the two spaces are, so you I didn't prove anything, of course, but it's two realizations of one and the same module. So
there's a definition of push forward, right, of a sheet.
Yes, it's rather not, it's not really a definition, it's a D-module. So to be precise, it should be a right D-module, and but there is a function of direct image.
Uh-huh.
And if you don't worry about, you know, honest geometry, if you just do it in coordinates, then it's very easy. So you have D-module on the line. You identify this line with this line. And you make vector fields and functions at here by simply, so you take the space of sections, A, and you identify it with the space, not quite, but at least the space of, take the space of sections on the interval. You identify this interval, the entire line is identified. So any interval here is identified with the interval here. And the question is, what is the space of sections of this push forward? And the answer is, I mean, let's work in coordinates. So suppose it's x and y. Pick your favorite transversal vector field, say dx or dy, or they're different, whichever you like more. Then the point is, the vector space of sections like this. You take A, you write formally A times whichever, ddx plus A ddx squared plus etc. This whole thing is naturally a D module on the plane.
So you mean these are kind of rather infinitesimal
derivations in the transversal. So, for example, if you pick an element here and ask yourself a question, how does ddx act there? Well, like this, right? How does a function act there? Well, functions vanishing here kill this thing. Functions, of course, this is all very coordinate dependent, but this can be said in a...
And why do you say that you can choose here dx or dy or anything?
It doesn't matter. The result is the same, because dx plus dy, dx plus dy kills what you begin with. So it's like, I mean, if you have some liking to of representation theory, that's just the choice of the vacuum. So you use this as a vacuum sort of component of a module where the big thing acts. And the reason, the point is, in this direction is the usual action, in this direction you just induce. And it is easy to see that this all makes sense. It's quite independent of the choice of coordinates.
So this is then more like a theorem, right?
Yeah, but you see, but then you want to somehow identify this with sort of functions in x and y. And you have to, I mean, what is the natural coordinate on the line? It's either x or y. If you choose x, then you write a formula like this. This is just a mnemonic device, how to remember the way you manipulate these things. So a long active differentiator is usual, and this thing, you know how. So it's just an explicit way to say the same thing. There are two such ways of saying it. There is Kshawarz's theorem, which says that the two are isomorphic. What's the isomorphism? The Taylor formula.
Is this two are isomorphic?
Yes, so that's all isomorphic, canonical.
But it's not like term by term, it's something.
Yeah, I wrote you the isomorphism.
That is actually the information.
Yes,
order.
Yes, yes, yes. Kashivara's theorem says that the category of the modules on the manifold is isomorphic. Suppose you have N, a submanifold in M. So the category of D modules on M, the N modules, is equivalent to the category of D modules on M, but supported on N. Of course, there are more D modules on M than on N, but some of them are supported on N. And supported means in the usual algebraic geometric sense, meaning that functions vanishing on N act nilpotently on the sections. And there is no choice. The only way you can proceed is that in the transversal direction, vector fields act freely. For representation theory, it's just a statement that Heisenberg-Lie algebra has only one reducible representation, that this algebra is so simple. In this case, I mean, it's Weyl algebra. It's really Heisenberg algebra. There aren't any submodules, so vector fields acting transversely may only act freely. And that's
so historically, it's not really the complex one, but with manifold in general, are you going to get more of these T's?
That's really the only difference. So,
then of course, we have more.
So the theorem goes like this. I think. So their chiral algebra on C is essentially the same as this. These have an extra property, I think. Well, no, if I'm not imposing anything extra, perhaps not. No, I guess not. It's just this. It's easy to show that this Q commutativity is the same as anti-commutativity there, and Q Jacobi is the same as Jacobi there. The only thing which is not quite obvious is that in this picture you don't have any action of functions. So I guess the idea is that you can always impose. There is the action of T is dx, and V is just the space of global sections. In his definition, in their definition, this carries the action of global functions, and in this case, this data is just missing. So you can, in principle, formally tensor it with. So I don't really know about the details. You can tensor it with functions and then extend all the axioms, and then you will get the same thing. Perhaps you can also somehow endow the thing with the action of functions so that they would bracket with T as they should. This I don't. There is a subtlety I never really thought carefully about.
This kind of monster, I think, is this definition is V a vector space always, or
yes, it's a vector space.
Because obviously there will be some, you can think about some of them as sheaves in the what you work.
So Balanz and Drinfeld talk about sheaves, and this is linear algebra. So apparently in the analogy this should be the space of global sections on the manifold in question. Perhaps C is the best manifold.
Are these operations it seems that
I just explained
can be defined for the sheaf, right, at the level of...
So here I'm working, obviously, with global sections,
right,
and I'm ignoring completely the action of functions, which in their definition should be present. So that's the only sort of difference. And there are two ways of overcoming it. There is a way of simply tensoring this with, say, polynomials in V, and requiring that T... Yes, and then you make T act on this as it acted before and on this by, so it should be, the T should be replaced with T tensor with DDZ. That's one way of getting around. And perhaps you can always introduce the action of functions on V itself so that, you see, this is not really an inverse functor. Functor in this direction is sort of obvious, and it forgets about the action of function. How to go in the opposite direction, I don't know. This is one of the ways to go, but this is not quite inverse. Perhaps there is a way of really establishing the equivalence. I never thought really about it carefully.
So, when you define the chiral algebra that you mentioned, is this also at the level of global sections?
No, chiral algebra is a sheaf, a D-module. So chiral algebra, for example, may exist on some particular algebraic curve and not exist on other algebraic curves. If you do this carefully, you get sort of universal chiral algebra, which lives on all curves simultaneously and agrees with etal mappings. For this, I think you need a little bit of extra data. I think you need not only T, if you think of T as DDZ, you also need all other vector fields on the disk, Z squared, DDZ, and things like that, I think. But then you will get a sort of universal chiral algebra. But the point is that these axioms by themselves are exactly the anti-symmetricity and Jacobi in this geometric setting. That's, of course, standard derivation in D-module theory. So that was my point, that all of this is forced upon us.
I've never seen it done. It's always scary.
It's a very long talk, you know.
X can be a coordinate on a circle.
Yes.
So
yes.
You can replace f of x by the Fourier model. That's what
yes,
I usually do.
Of course.
And product takes a simple form?
Yes, of course.
How does it look like?
It's exactly this. Bn is then...
Bn of A is with respect to using the
remote
of Am. How does it look? And then take A.
Well, if you think of this as a sort of operator, so this is another way of explaining the same thing. So with B, I associate infinitely many operators. So you can combine them into a generating function and call it B of Z. And that's exactly the language you're used to.
And, okay. Sorry, this Bn times A is a product?
You take B of Z, you apply it to A, you get a formal... any element of V. No, that's an element of V. Then you... No. This doesn't make sense. This has to be regularized or whatever. But this does. And that's a family of elements. You know, this is just BNA. V. That's a formal generating function of a family of elements in the vector space.
Okay, so A can be regarded as something like this.
Yes, you can identify A with this gadget,
call,
yes.
Call this.
Yes.
And B can be said this.
Uh-huh.
And B can it is what's the N of Fourier
function? I mean, yeah, that depends.
It depends. Sum over N plus K plus L.
Well, the usual axioms hold. In the vertex algebra K, the usual axioms hold.
Is this?
Yes, yes.
Oh, I see.
Yes,
maybe
yes. Yes, 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 of course.
Oh,
especially when N is negative. I'm working in this quasi-classical limit, so I'm not using this for negative N, but if you do... the quantum situation, then exactly this. B, for example, B minus 1, A of Z is exactly B of Z, A of Z, normally ordered. That's just how mathematicians are trying to cope with all this. That's one of the Borchert identities written in this language. This I was also planning to explain. You see, but the problem is that's quasi-classical limit. So this really, for example, this is just your familiar form. It's just an explicit form of the familiar formula for what this says. Is simply how you would compute. This thing, Z to some power, W to some power, that's exactly what you would do. You would write this thing equals A of Z minus W applied to B, evaluated of W, and then you multiply by the same powers and integrate. That's exactly your language, except that I put it in this more mathematically. Except, but and I actually wanted to use things like that later on. But
what did you say about practical axioms?
No, it's vertex plus one.
Okay, so what you're talking about is vertex algebra, and then you're just taking a limit of that algebra in some sense.
That's how, you remember how what I started with. How do you arrive naturally to the notion of Poisson algebra?
Yeah, well, I'm
you use...
Is that true?
Well, there is no such theorem that any vertex Poisson algebra is a quasi-classical limit of some vertex algebra. What is true is that you can define the quasi-classical limit. Suppose you have a vertex algebra,
right,
and suppose its classical limit is commutative, and this can be explained. Then at the limit, you have this structure.
Yeah,
that's a quasi-classical limit.
So it's a quasi-classical limit of in the situation you talk about this kind of vertex algebra.
Yes. But if you have this, then it's in general problematic if you can quantize it, but in some cases you can.
Oh, okay, so quantizing is get back to the
vertex
algebra.
Yeah, get back to the vertex
algebra. Oh, okay.